Radio.
Jobs Not Jails. A talk by Father Greg Boyle at Australian Catholic University.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. It's a real privilege to be with you. You know, watching that film, you get homesick. You know, I feel like I left Friday night, so Los Angeles, and so it's been whatever it is, 6 days, or you lose 3 days, or I don't know how this works, but I've been getting text messages from homies in Los Angeles, and they're always filled with news. You know, a homie had twins. They're preemies, so they're kind of in the hospital right now, but you know, was please come and bless them. You know, it's just very touching. I remember once I got home and there was a homie sitting there in my office named Lupe, and he was so excited. And the gang member at the front desk said, he's been here like for 3 days waiting for you. And so when I see Lupe, he gives me a big abrazo, as they like to give abrazos. And he said, while you were gone, my son was born. I said, wow, nice going. Congratulations. When was he born? On his birthday, he said to me. I said, wow, what are the chances of that happening? So I apologize. Some of you have heard me before because, meet people who've either seen videos. You know, YouTube is the bane of my existence, you know. And I once spoke at a foster grandparent gathering in Southern California. And I had spoken at it the summer before, and I don't know why they invited me 2 summers in a row, but there you have it. And so most of these people had all heard my stuff before. And afterwards, this grandmother came up to me and had big tears in her eyes. And she grabbed both my hands and she said, I heard you last year. It never gets better. So I'm kind of hoping she misspoke there, but I'm not entirely sure. So anyway, there's a vision that brings you here at night, you know, when you could probably do something else. And in the end, everybody in this room wants the world to look differently than it currently looks. A vision is very important. The prophet Habakkuk writes, the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and it will not disappoint. And if it delays, wait for it. But none of us want to wait too long. We want to make things happen, like the great folks here from Exodus who've made something happen. I encourage you to go to their cafe, which I would love to do at some point if I'm able to do it. But you want to make something happen. You don't wait for stuff to fall out of the sky. In the end, you have to make things happen. But in the end, what's the hope? You know, what does God long for us to do? I think God just wants us to create a community of kinship such that God, in fact, might recognize it. I read a prayer the other day. A great theologian ended the prayer by saying, well, it's not about me. It's about you talking to God. And I remember thinking, really? We presume that's the truth. If I were God, I would want it to be about me. But God is kind of more humble than I am, and God wants it to be about us, that you may be one. God invites us to a sense of who God is that is spacious, and we settle for partial. We're invited to holiness, we settle for purity and piety. We're invited to kinship, and we settle for separation. All of us are invited to imagine a circle of compassion and then imagine nobody standing outside that circle. And so we're invited to dismantle the barriers that exclude. We're invited to this spacious inclusion, but we settle for tiny exclusion. And so we're invited to stand at the margins because that's the only way I know that margins get erased. If you stand at the margins, look under your feet, the margins are getting erased just because you chose to stand there. And so you stand with the poor and the powerless and the voiceless, and you stand with those whose dignity has been denied, and you stand with those whose burdens are more than they can bear. And then you find this exhilaration to be able to stand with the easily despised and the readily left out. It doesn't get better than that. And then you get to stand with the demonized so that the demonizing will stop. And with the disposable so that the day will come when we stop throwing people away. I suspect that if kinship was in fact our goal, we would no longer be promoting justice. We'd be celebrating it. So for 30 years, it's been such a great privilege to accompany people and to know gang members. And they've taught me everything of value. But in the last couple of years, they've taught me how to text, and I'm so grateful to them. In fact, we even have a case available online, probably, at a low, low price, no doubt. But the homies have taught me how to text, and I'll tell you, it's weird that you can text from Australia. I just don't even get what that means, you know? And they just said goodnight to me, several hours ago, because it's about 2 in the morning or something yesterday. I still don't get it, but they've taught me how to text, you know, LOL and OMG and BTW. And they've taught me a new one, OHN, which apparently stands for, oh, hell no. And I really, trust me, I've been using that one quite a bit lately. So there I am in a car with two homies, Manuel and Poncho, and they're older guys, older vatos. We say vatos, you know, that's the Latino gang. Older vatos who have been to prison and tattooed, and they do a variety of things at Homeboy. And so they're going to help me give a talk. And so Manuel's in the front seat, and suddenly he gets an incoming. So he reads the text to himself, and he chuckles. And I said, well, what is it? And he goes, oh, it's dumb. It's from Snoopy back at the office. Well, Snoopy, I just seen Snoopy. He just gave me a big abrazote as the day was beginning. And Snoopy and Manuel work together in the clock-in room, where they clock in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of our workers. It's a hard job because they get a lot of attitude, you know. And so I just seen him. I said, well, what's he say? He goes, oh, it's dumb. Hang on. Hey, dog, it's me, Snoops. Yeah, they got my ass locked up at county jail. They're charging me with being the ugliest vato in America. You have to come down right now, show them they got the wrong guy. Well, I almost swerved into oncoming traffic, you know, and we died laughing, laugh. And then I realized that Manuel and Snoopy are in fact enemies. They used to shoot bullets at each other. Now they shoot text messages. And there's a word for that, and the word is kinship. How do we obliterate once and for all the illusion that we are separate, that there is an us and a them? We're invited to us. We settle for them. And so we don't look at God and say, it's not about me, it's about you. God looks at us and says, I appreciate it. But it's not about me either. It's about us. That's God's dream come true. I was at a juvenile hall, and I was listening to the first reading. And I had my eyes closed, and I had the little liturgical aid sitting on my lap. And I'm all vested, and I'm presiding. And we're in the gym, and there are 300 gang members in there. And the gang member got up to read. And they're usually not so good. They stumble on stuff, you know. At Christmas time, a kid got up and talked about how the three magi had brought gifts of gold and Frankenstein. And I said, finally, a gift the kid's going to like. You know, what's he going to do with myrrh after all? So, but he got up and he was so overconfident, I could hardly believe this. And I'm listening, and you know, I'm trying to not read along. I want to hear the word proclaimed. And he got up and he said, the Lord is exhausted, he said. So I look exhausted. I look at the sheet and it said, the Lord is exalted, you know. And I remember instantaneously thinking, wow, that's way better, isn't it? You know, I think it's just way better that the Lord would be exhausted. Because he has no interest in being exalted. That's what we do because we create God in our own image, and I want to be exalted, and I want people to say my name over and over again. But God has no interest in that. He's too busy being exhausted, delighting, too busy loving to have any time left to be disappointed. Everybody knows, at least the way we, you know, there's an expression in the States, you know, if you say, how are you feeling? And, oh, I'm exhausted. But it's a good tired. Really, why? Well, I helped move so-and-so into her new apartment, or, oh, I was playing with my grandkids all day. I'm beat, I'm tired. But it's a good tired. And we have a God who exhausts himself in delighting in us. All of us are doomed to imitate the kind of God we believe in. If ours is tiny, brace yourself. You have no choice but to be tiny. But if you believe in a God who's spacious and expansive and inclusive and exhausted, you'll be that way too. So Homeboy Industries, as a Christian mentioned, was born a long time ago when I was pastor of a very poor parish. A lot of gangs, the highest concentration of gang activity in all of Los Angeles was my parish. I didn't know this when I got there. We had 8 gangs at war with each other in these 2 public housing projects. They were all at war. And I started to bury kids in 1988. My first kid I buried there, a kid named Rafael. And 3 months ago, I buried my 194th young person killed in our streets for no reason whatsoever. In the early days, we had a lot of gang members who weren't going to school because they got the boot from their homeschool. Nobody wanted them. So I remember walking out to the projects where they were wreaking havoc and violent and selling drugs. And I went to every single one. I said, if I found a school that would take you, would you go? And to my surprise, they all said yes. And then I couldn't find a school that would take them. You know, that kind of forced my hand a little bit. So I went to the convent, which in those days was on the 3rd floor of our elementary school. So you had the parochial school, had the 2 first floors. And the whole 3rd floor, the nuns lived there. So I gathered the nuns in the living room and I said, hey, would you guys mind, you know, moving out? And we could turn the convent into like a school for gang members. And they were remarkable. They said, sure. And they moved out. And gang members came to the church in large numbers, which kind of upset the apple cart a little bit, because aren't churches supposed to be hermetically sealed? You know, good people in and bad people out. And so this was a good gospel challenge. And then the gang members would say, you know, if only we had jobs. So part of the trick, I think, in standing with folks on the margins is to listen. We all come with preconceived notions of what we think will fix things or help people. But if you listen, people will tell you what they need. So myself and the women in the parish, we marched around the housing projects trying to find felony-friendly employers, and that wasn't so forthcoming. So by 1992 in Los Angeles, we had the unrest, the Rodney King beatings, and maybe you heard of any of that. And so I had a movie producer come to me, and he wanted to help. And I said, buy this old bakery across the street from the church, and we'll call it Homeboy Bakery. That was the extent of my business plan. I hadn't thought it out. I hadn't thought anything out except, how about we call it Homeboy Bakery? And so we put hairnets on all these rival enemy gang members, and they started to bake bread together. And a month later, we started Homeboy Tortillas in the Grand Central Market in downtown LA, kind of a historic part of the city. Once we had plural, I said, well, let's call ourselves Homeboy Industries, as if there was any industry involved in this venture. Not everything worked. Anything worth doing is worth failing at. Homeboy Plumbing really was not hugely successful. Who knew? People didn't want gang members in their homes. I did not get that memo. That one just, I didn't see it coming at all. And nobody ever intends or sets out to do stuff. You can go to our headquarters, and I hope you will, and people go, wow, how did you think this up? And I said, the truth is, nobody thought this up. You back yourselves into things. This is how anything works. So we evolved, I guess, and now we're quite large, and every gang member, 120,000 members of them in L.A. County, they all know Homeboy. They may or may not be ready to walk through our doors because we're not there for people who need us. We're only there for those who want help. So they come in, 15,000 a year, walk through our doors and sniff around. Some of them are lucky to get into our training program. That's 18 months. And so we have a variety of things from anger management to grief and loss to parenting, you name it. Anything that might be helpful in terms of curricular things. We have a huge mental health team, 5 that are paid, and 47 or so volunteer therapists. So everybody's in therapy, trying to transform their pain so they no longer have to transmit it. Case managers, we have lots of those, so everybody has a case manager. Free tattoo removal, no place on the planet Earth removes more tattoos. I got asked the other night, can't remember where that was, in Canberra, I think, why would you remove tattoos? And again, it may not be an issue here, and then everybody, non-gang members have tattoos, you know. But it's kind of an issue. It's not just an obstacle to future employment for gang members. It's also provocative, you know. So if on your face you have a provocative, tattoo, everybody in this room has made mistakes. Most of them you can't erase, but tattoos you can. So we have 3 laser machines, a designated clinic, 1 paid physician assistant, but 40-plus volunteer doctors who give their time, 14,000 treatments a year. And it all started because of a guy named Frank who wandered into my office 2 days out of Corcoran State Prison. I'd never met him, and there he is sitting in front of me. And tattooed on his forehead like a billboard, it literally filled the entire space, was the world. And he said, you know, I am having a hard time finding a job. And I said, Frank, maybe, we could put our heads together on this one, So I hired him, and he baked bread for, he actually didn't bake bread, he bagged bread for 2 years. And then I went to a local hospital that had a dermatologist and a laser machine who I cajoled into giving me 1 hour a month to chip away on Frank's forehead and a few other people. And then suddenly I had a waiting list of 3,000 gang members who wanted the very same service. Again, I never told any gang member, you need to get rid of that. They told me that, is there any way I could get rid of this? So we did a lot of things in order to get to where we are now. And now we're pretty much 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, tattoo removal. A parenthesis, Frank is a security guard currently at a movie studio in Hollywood, and there is no trace left of the dumbest damn thing he had ever put on his face, proving once and for all that all of us in this room and outside of it are a whole lot more than the worst things you've ever done. What else? So we have a lot of training programs. We start new things. Just before we left, we started Homeboy Environmental Services, which means we got sort of a contract to clean storm drains or something. So we're sending homies into the sewers. And they're happy as clams. You know, they came back just before I left to come here, just covered in the most extraordinary filth. And they were, I said, oh, hail, O-H-N, oh, hail, no. Can I wave at a distance at you? But seriously, they were just so exhilarated, you know, because these were mostly all postgraduates, guys who had finished their 18 months with us. and then moving now on to life after Homeboy. We have solar panel installation training program, which is our most successful training program. And then all our social enterprises, our businesses, Homeboy Bakery, which is 24/7 baking, every imaginable kind of baked good. We sell to restaurants and hotels and that kind of thing. We have Homeboy Silkscreen, which you saw in the film. That's been around for about 20 years. We have Homeboy Diner, the only place you can buy food in City Hall. We're in 40-plus, what do you call them, farmers markets where we sell our wares. Homeboy Homegirl merchandise where we sell our logo things, right there. We are, what else are we doing? So there are eight somewhere in there. We have a restaurant at LAX, so the next time you fly through, although it's not the international terminal, but if you're not staying in LA and you're going to fly to some other place, American Airlines, that's where we are. I know I'm missing something. Well, Homegirl Cafe, where women with records, young ladies from rival gangs, waitresses with attitude will gladly take your order. And we cater. Lately, it's always sort of been a famous place where people, a who's who, people are always coming to my office and they're saying, Jim Carrey, you know, the actor, he's in the cafe, or the mayor is in the cafe, or the chief of police is in the cafe. So once we had the entire Dodgers, you know what the Dodgers are, LA Dodgers baseball? They were all there. It was pandemonium. Famously, Diane Keaton came once for lunch, and she was she of Academy Award fame and Godfather movies, big movie star. She was there with a regular, a guy who's there once a week. And her waitress this day is Glenda, and Glenda's a homegirl, been there, done that, tattooed, big girl, felon, parolee. She has no clue who Diane Keaton is, you know, so she's taking her order. And Diane Keaton graciously says, what do you recommend? And Glenda rattles off the three dishes that she particularly likes. And then Diane Keaton says, I'll have that second one. That one sounds good. And for some reason, it's at that moment that Glenda looks at Diane Keaton. She says, wait a minute. I feel like I know you from somewhere. You know, like maybe we've met. And Diane Keaton decides to deflect it humbly. You know, oh, gosh, I don't know. I suppose I have one of those faces, you know, that people think they've seen before. And then Glenda goes, no, now I know. We were locked up together. That just took my breath away when I heard it. And I don't believe we've had any further Diane Keaton sightings now that I think of it. But suddenly, kinship so quickly, Oscar-winning actress, attitudinal waitress, exactly what God had in mind. And we already know what's on God's mind because Jesus points the way. That you may be one. And that's what we need to work towards. This kinship and this connection. In the film, there's a huge picture of Cesar Chavez, who's famous in Los Angeles, in the States, really. He's the Martin Luther King of farm workers. And privilege of my life to say that he was a friend and I knew him. He was an extraordinary listener. If you were talking to Cesar Chavez, nobody else existed but you. It's a great gift he had among many. But a reporter famously said to him once, wow, these farm workers, they sure love you. And Cesar just shrugged and smiled and said, the feeling's mutual. And that's the whole point in our ministry, is to get to this place of exquisite mutuality where there is no us and them, but where we believe we're not rescuing or saving anybody except probably ourselves. There's a gulf even between service provider and service recipient. Begin at service, but don't end at service. Service is the hallway that leads you to the ballroom. You want to get to the ballroom, which is the place of exquisite mutuality. And it's the privilege of my life to know the people I do. And again, it just made me homesick. So thank you for playing that film. Just because the day won't ever come when I have more courage, or I am more noble, or I am closer to God than the people I've been privileged to know. I'm not the great healer, and they're not in need of my exquisite healing. We're all a cry for help. It's the thing that joins us together as human beings. And there is no daylight that separates us, and God's hoping we'll discover that truth. There was a homie, nobody found more jobs through Homeboy Industries than this guy, Dreamer. Everybody called him Dreamer. That was his gang name. I knew him since he was a little kid growing up in the projects, and he was just a very smart kid with a dangerous sense of humor, brilliantly funny, but never did too well in school. He never stayed in school. And so he got into a gang and got into trouble and was a yo-yo for a period in his life, in and out of being locked up. But he'd come to me and then he'd say what gang members often say. This time it'll be different, but he endlessly did this. I'd find him a job in the private sector in one of our businesses, but he'd keep gravitating back to vague criminality, usually something involving drugs or the sale of or the use of, and he'd wander back to me. So this one time he came again and he said, this time it'll be different. I said, okay. So I picked up the phone with him sitting there and I called a friend of mine who had hired homies in the past, a guy named Gary. He ran a vending machine company. And sure enough, he hired a Dreamer right on the spot. And that is a holy man right there who will do something like that. Sure, send him. You can start tomorrow. So Dreamer began to work at the vending machine company. Well, 2 weeks later, there he is again in my office. And I go, híjole, Madre Santa, here we go again. I mean, I can't believe this. But this time he reached into his pocket and he pulled out this envelope. And in it is his very first paycheck. And he said, damn, gee, this paycheck makes me feel proper. I mean, my mom, she's proud of me. And my kids, they're not ashamed of me. And you know who I have to thank for this job. And I said, well, gosh, who? And he looked at me strangely and he said, well, God, of course. Oh, sure. No, no. No, that's right. That would be God right there. Yeah. He said, you thought I was going to say you. I said, no, no. God. No, God's number one. Yeah. And he said, you are so lucky we're not living in them Genesis days. And I'm sorry, them Genesis days? He goes, yeah, because God would have been had struck down your ass already by now, he said. You know. All I remember is we just fell out of our chairs. We laughed so hard. And suddenly kinship so quickly. I defy you to identify exactly who is the service provider, who's the service recipient. I have no idea. It's mutual. All of us are called to be what Alice Miller, the late great child psychologist, called enlightened witnesses. People who through your kindness and tenderness and focused, attentive love return people to themselves. You don't hold the bar up and ask anybody to measure up. You just show up and you hold the mirror up and you tell people the truth, knowing that your truth is my truth. And my truth is a gang member's truth, and it all happens to be the same truth. And here's the truth. And I'm glad you're sitting down. You are exactly what God had in mind when God made you. And then you watch folks on the margins as they become that truth, as they inhabit that truth, and no bullet can pierce it. No four prison walls can keep it out. And death can't touch it because it's huge. Don't ask people to measure up. For a very simple reason. God doesn't ask you to measure up. God, in fact, wonders, what's all the measuring about? For our God is too busy loving us to have any time left. But in our biz, and I am almost certain the folks at Exodus can connect with me on this one. Occasionally, you have to reach in and dismantle the messages of shame and disgrace that get in the way, that keep people from seeing their truth. That's all you do, is you kind of help them see it. The great scripture scholar Marcus Borg says that the principal suffering of the poor throughout history and throughout scripture is shame and disgrace, and I think that's quite right. I look at this guy, Jose, who it's so how understated he is. You know, he says, you know, my mom did the best she could, he says, but her best was violent, he says. Once I had to speak to 600 social workers in Richmond, Virginia, and sometimes I don't pay that much attention about what I'm supposed to do, and I thought it was a keynote, one talk. Then I looked carefully at it, and it was an in-service all day, 9 to 5, on gangs. I was the only speaker. What am I thinking? So I quickly invited these two guys. It's funny that they're both in this film, as luck would have it. And so I invited them to go with me. And I told them, I said, look, get up and tell your stories. Take your time. We have a long-ass day to fill. And so Jose got up, and he was just as offhanded as he was here, which is kind of, it's so intriguing that he would be. He said, I guess you could say my mom and me, we didn't get along so good. I think I was 6, he says. And she looked at me and she said, why don't you just kill yourself? You're such a burden to me. Well, the whole 600 social workers, they gasped. And he said, it sounds way worser in Spanish, he said, you know. And then we laughed. It was like it was, we got, you know, we needed a laugh 1 minute in. He said, I guess I was 9 when my mom drove me to the deepest part of Baja California, and she walks me up to an orphanage. She knocks on the door, and the guy comes to the door, and she says, I found this kid. And she left me there for 90 days until my grandmother could get out of her where she had dumped me, and my grandmother rescued me. My mom beat me every single day of my elementary school years with things you could imagine and a lot of things you couldn't. Every day my back was bloodied and scarred. In fact, I had to wear 3 t-shirts to school every day. First t-shirt, because the blood would seep through. And the second t-shirt, because you could still see the blood. Finally, the third t-shirt, you couldn't see any blood. Kids at school, they make fun of me. Hey, fool, it's 100 degrees. Why are you wearing 3 t-shirts? And then he stopped speaking. Got overwhelmed and began to choke up and couldn't speak. And he seemed to be staring at a piece of his story that only he could see. And when he could speak, he said through his tears, I wore 3 t-shirts well into my adult years because I was ashamed of my wounds. I didn't want anybody to see him. But now I welcome my wounds. I run my fingers over my scars. My wounds are my friends. After all, how can I help heal the wounded if I don't welcome my own wounds? And as they say in the Acts of the Apostles, and awe came upon everyone. We are called to stand in awe at what people have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it. For the measure of our compassion lies not in our service of those on the margins, but in our willingness to see ourselves in kinship with them. You always want to get this diagnosis right. Whatever it is that you want to diagnose, whatever complex social dilemma faces you in Sydney or in this country. Nobody in this room has ever met a healthy treatment plan that was born of a bad diagnosis. That's never happened. In fact, you could never get to a good, healthy plan with a bad diagnosis. Years ago when I had leukemia and had to go through chemotherapy, and I'm feeling okay at the moment, here I am in Sydney, or as the homies say, I hear your cancer's in intermission. And I said, yes, apparently it's stepped out to the lobby to buy popcorn. May the line be long. I had a kind of a couple months ago, I had to go back into treatment. So word travels fast among homies. So I got a call from a guy named Jason from jail, collect. And he said, you got to be honest with me. And I said, I will. Are you dying? He said to me. And I said, no, I'm not dying. He goes, I thought so. I told this guy, I know G has cancer, but he's getting that shit fixed, he said, you know. And I said, slow down with the medical jargon because it's really hard for me to keep up with you, you know. So, but anyway, I went to a doctor who I no longer go to, and he said I had mononucleosis. So he treated me for a year for mono. And I think we can all agree there's probably a difference between mono and leukemia. But there's the difference. You know, once somebody finally discovered that I, in fact, had leukemia, I had to be rushed into chemo. I had to go fast. No bad diagnosis is neutral. It puts you behind the eight ball. You have to play catch-up. That's why you always want to get diagnoses right. I was sorry to discover the other night that you know who Dr. Phil is. Yeah, sorry about that. But anyway, there I was on the Dr. Phil show. And what was I thinking? But there I was on the Dr. Phil show. And so he said, his people said, we'll promote my book and spend an hour on Homeboy Industries. I thought, well, how bad can this be? And we thought we had talked his producers down from doing something so silly. And so there I am backstage, and I can hear Dr. Phil. And he says, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the founder and executive director of Homeboy Industries, Father Greg Boyle. So I go out there, and it's a kind of an audience thing in bleachers. People are clapping. To my horror, there's Phil sitting in his stool in the middle of the stage. My empty stool is next to him, awaiting me. On his side of the stage is a beautiful, gorgeous mahogany coffin. On those four little wheel dolly deals. My side of the stage is a perfectly reconstructed jail cell with sink and toilet and bed and bars. I mean, they went to great expense for this thing. Well, you already know where this is going to go. So the producers fly in three young males, 14, 15, 16, African-American, Latino, and a white kid, all with their single mothers, very distraught single mothers, and each kid apparently is gravitating perilously close to some kind of gang involvement. They bring them out one at a time, and I'm there supposed to give advice. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and with each kid, Phil sort of grabs each one figuratively by the lapel. Don't you see where this choice is going to lead you? Death or prison. Finally, by the third kid, I just couldn't take it anymore. I said, Phil, how do I break this to you? These kids know this will lead to death or prison. They don't need more data. They're not awaiting more information. They know this will lead to death or prison. They don't care that it will. This is the urban poor's version of teenage suicide. This is about a lethal absence of hope. This is about kids unable to imagine a future for themselves. If you can't imagine a future for yourself, your present isn't very compelling. And if your present doesn't compel you, you cease to care whether you inflict harm, and you do not care whether you duck to get out of harm's way. For no kid is seeking anything when he joins a gang. He's always fleeing something, and there are no exceptions, and I've never met an exception, not once, never. Parentheses, so I'm always I say mass on a rotating basis, Saturday and Sunday, in about 25 different detention facilities. We have lots of them, unfortunately, in Los Angeles. We have about 20 what they call probation camps for kids who stay, almost all gang members, and they're there from 6 months to 9 months, sometimes longer. So there I am in a gym, and there are about 100 gang members in there, and I say mass, and after mass, you know, I'm still vested. They'll come around, you know, and I'm cleaning up and packing stuff up, and kids always want my card, because I hand out thousands of my card, millions of my card a year, you know. And there was a kid the other day, and he said, hey, how do I get your credit card? I said, jack my wallet, I guess. I don't, oh, you mean this? Well, that's, there you go. So they, you know, so we're talking, and a kid says to me, hey, I saw you on Oprah. I said, well, no, not Oprah. Actually, I was on Dr. Phil. And he goes, oh, I said, yeah, I have a hard time telling those two apart myself, you know, and and this kid over here says, you were on Dr. Phil fighting with your wife? And all these guys died laughing. And I said, yeah, you know, but he really gave us good advice and we're doing much better. I'll tell her you were asking for. Anyway, that was a digression that I don't know how to retrieve myself from. Anyway, it's important to get the diagnosis right. And you do that mainly by listening. But it's interesting because you always hear this thing. Well, of course, we know gang members join kids join gangs because they want to belong and excitement and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's only because sometimes if you ask gang members, that's what they'll tell you. But you wouldn't want to believe them because it's easier to say that than to say my mom put cigarettes out on me. And she held my head in the toilet and flushed till I nearly drowned. That's the reason why that kid joined a gang. But it's easier to say, I joined the gang to see the world and wine, women, and song. Anyway, let me end with the story and then I open it up for you guys to say stuff. I'll anticipate a question. People always ask about enemies working together and it's decidedly dicey. A homie will come in and say, I'm ready, ready, ready. And I said, okay, I have an opening in the bakery, but you have to work with X, Y, and Z. And I rattle off the names of rivals, enemies. And the homie always does the same thing. He sits there and he thinks for a long time. And then he finally says, okay, I'll work with them. I'm not going to talk to them. And this used to bother me in the old days. And it really bothered me. Until you discover, of course, that no human being can demonize somebody they know. Human beings can't sustain that. So I had a homie everybody called Youngster. He was 19 years old, little chaparrito, little tiny guy. And sometimes I call gang members by their placas, by their nicknames. You know, if they're benign, you know, Youngster or Flaco or Lefty, you know. I won't call anybody Psycho. Or, Sniper or something like that, you know. I had a homie, big, huge guy tattooed right out of prison. I said, what do your homies call you? Fluffy. I said, oh, I am trembling in my boots, Mr. Fluff. So Youngster was ready. I thought he was ready. So I bring him into our homeboy Silkscreen where we had an opening. And so I was introducing him to the 30 co-workers there on the floor of the, you know, our big, huge factory, which is kind of off campus from our headquarters. And I watch this guy, Youngster, as he shakes hands with every single one, looks him in the eye. Enemies, there were a lot of enemies, a lot of rivals. He shook hands with every single one. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, this is great. Until he gets to the last guy, and the last guy's name was Puppet. And Puppet seems to be wanting to avoid this encounter altogether. And when Puppet and Youngster are in each other's vicinity, they mumble something, they stare at their shoes, they don't shake hands. Well, I know they're enemies because I know what gangs they're from. But this kid just finished shaking hands with other enemies. But I discover later that this is a hatred that's really quite deep and personal, and beyond which neither of them think they can really get past. So I sense that much at the moment, and I say, look, if you guys can't hang working together, let me know, because I got a bunch of people who want this job. Calladitos, they don't say a word. Well, 6 months later, a puppet leaves his home one day to go to a corner store some distance from his house, and he purchases something. And then on the way home, for some reason, he decides to take a shortcut, so he dodges into an alley. And because he's taken this detour, suddenly, unexpectedly, he's surrounded by 10 members of a rival gang, 10 against 1. And they beat him badly. And he falls to the ground, and while he's lying on the ground, they just will not stop kicking his head until he's lifeless. Somebody finds his body and takes him to White Memorial Hospital, where he's declared effectively brain dead. But it's the policy there, of course, to keep you connected to machines for 48 hours to see if you can get 2 straight days of a flat read with no brain activity. And then after the 48 hours, the doctors can sign the death certificate, making it official. So this allowed family and friends to gather a little bit of time. I was at St. Louis University giving a talk. I flew home immediately. I've seen a lot of horrible things in my life, but nothing to compare to the sight of this young man with his head swollen many times its size. It was just horrifying. You could barely train your eyes on him. So at the end of the 48-hour period, I gave him a blessing and anointed his forehead with oil. We disconnected, and a week later we buried him. But in the first 24 hours, as Puppet was lying beaten in the hospital, I was alone in my office. It was 8:30 at night, and the phone rings, and it's Youngster, Puppet's co-worker from the silkscreen. "Hey," he says, "that's messed up about what happened to Puppet." I said, "Yeah, it is." And then with a certain kind of eagerness even, he says, "Is there anything I can do? Can I give him my blood?" And we both fall silent under the weight of it, until finally he breaks the silence and he says with great deliberation, "He was not my enemy. He was my friend. We work together." Now, can I say that always happens at Homeboy Industries? Of course it does. Any exceptions? I can't think of a single time. And it shouldn't surprise us that God's own dream come true for us, that we be one, just happens to be our own deepest longing for ourselves. For it turns out it's mutual. So we're called to do one thing, and this is God's hope, that we create a community of kinship such that God, in fact, might recognize it. For the vision still has its time, presses on to fulfillment, and will not disappoint. And if it delays, we wait for it. Thank you very much.
That was a talk by Father Greg Boyle at Australian Catholic University. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.